¿Quieres mejor internet? Cox Internet de 300 megas tiene las velocidades rápidas y confiables que buscas. Perfecto para streaming y gaming y trabajar desde casa. Yeah. Todo por solo $45 al mes cuando agregas Cox Mobile. Incluye equipo de Wi-Fi y garantía de precio de 2 años en tu plan. Yeah. No esperes. Cámbiate hoy a Cox. Requiere Cox Mobile Gig Unlimited. Garantía de precio no incluye impuestos y cargos. Velocidad de datos móviles se reduce después de 20 gigas al mes.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hello and welcome to Brokenomics. And in this episode, I'm going to be looking at the science behind face masks. Now, obviously, in Brokenomics, I spend a lot of time looking at how our political and economic systems are badly designed, corrupt, stuffed with bad incentives. And we know that our money and politics is broken. It's leading to an agenda-driven, harmful outcomes. But it would be nice to think, at least in the world of academia, we have disinterested truth-seekers doggedly pursuing enlightenment, no matter where it leads and getting at the hard evidence. And today I'm joined by Dr. Hector Drummond, who is a former academic with a PhD, who was one of the earliest and most prominent academics to take a vigorous look at the data early on in the pandemic, who quickly identified a number of gaping holes in all sorts of aspects of the response. Now, 100% of which he has subsequently been proved entirely correct on. Hector, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me, Dan.
Now, Hector, before you completely dismantle the case for face masks, let's just recap where we were early on in the COVID hysteria of 2020. I've got a video here which shows what the powers to be were saying and where it sort of suddenly flipped on us. Let's have a look at this.
The evidence on face masks has always been quite variable, quite weak, quite difficult to know exactly, and there's no real trials on it. And we've undertaken a review. We'll give our advice to ministers and they'll make decisions about what to do around that.
Many countries have been buying a face mask, as have we. But the position on face masks is unchanged.
In terms of wearing a mask, our advice is clear that wearing a mask, if you don't have an infection, really reduces the risk almost not at all. So we do not advise that.
What I'd say is that on face masks, we are guided by the science, and the government position hasn't changed. Professor McLean will explain the science. The government position, the UK government position, hasn't changed. Not least because the most important thing people can do is the social distancing.
The recommendation from SAGE is completely clear, which is that there is weak evidence of a small effect in which a face mask can prevent a source of infection going from somebody who is infected to the people around them. But the answer is clear that the evidence is weak and the effect is small, and we've passed that on to our colleagues in government with which to make a decision.
I can announce that as of Monday the 15th of June, face coverings will become mandatory on public transport.
So the evidence was perfectly clear. Masks were nonsense. And yet something flipped in June 2020. And they started forcing us into these masks. They, of course, served the dual purpose of terrifying the simple-minded. And they gave them this constant fear-inducing reminder that death was everywhere. And for those of us not so easily fooled, we were forced into accepting either the humiliation of wearing something that we knew was pure propaganda, or facing getting into confrontations with idiots in shops who thought that they knew something because the telly had told them. Now, personally, I chose the confrontation route because I actually quite enjoy it. But a lot of sensible people gave in and they wore one just to avoid the confrontation, the fights that came from it. And of course, it spread, it metastasized. And before long, school kids were forced to wear it for a disgracefully long time. So this was an utterly revolting overreach by the government. And Hector, you've got to the bottom of the evidence that they used to force this on us. Was it good quality evidence, Hector?
It was terrible quality, frankly. Let's face it. I mean, there were two reviews that made all the difference, because there was a bunch of studies rushed out which a lot of scientists and government officials used to try and justify their change of mind. Mm. But the main thing that made a difference was two studies or two meta-analyses, both of which came from the Royal Society. The first one was called the Delve Report, and the second one was called the Royal Society Report.
Two substantial studies, because I remember at the time I was looking at this, and the media would often cite, you know, a new study has come up saying that masks work. Because I mean, early on in the pandemic, I looked at this, and I found various, you know, high quality studies. I think there was a Vietnamese hospital study, and there was a couple of others as well that looked at thousands of people and done the whole study stuff, and they always found no statistical evidence one way or the other. And then I looked at the studies that were coming out that were being pushed by the media early on, and whenever I sort of click through, and they never make it that easy to follow it, but whenever yes. I did follow it through, what I was finding was a study was basically a survey of doctors. And of course, you know, just because you're a doctor doesn't mean you have magical knowledge. Unless it's something you have studied or looked into or done the research on or been trained in, you've got no more of an idea than anybody else. So they're basically just going around hospitals asking people who happen to be doctors, you know, do you think face masks would do the thing? They watched the TV as well, so they said yes. And that was the quality of study that was being talked about. But that's not what you're talking about, is it?
Well, a study where you just ask doctors doesn't really count as a study at all, I think. What I'm talking about, the two reviews, were they substantial? Only in the sense that they were very influential and were promoted heavily by the media. Mm-hmm. They weren't substantial studies in the sense that they were good studies or put forward any high quality evidence. They were terrible studies. So
what was the process that led there? So there's two underlying studies, but there has to be a waiver that connected to government. I mean, what route did this take to formalise it?
Well, they both came out through the Royal Society. Mm-hmm. And as you probably know, the Royal Society has become very politicised in recent years. So the Royal Society was full of people, I think, wanting to push masks. I mean, I'm kind of guessing here, but it's a pretty educated guess. The Royal Society was full of people behind the scenes who were wanting to push masks, who for whatever reasons thought masks would be a great idea to have everyone masked up. So they decided to get some working groups together to do some rapid reviews of the evidence. And the main reason behind that seemed to be that they wanted to push masks, really.
Okay. So, I mean, essentially what you're alleging is they sort of went into this looking to find evidence that fit a presupposition.
Yeah, very much
so. Is that common in academia?
It is, and as you will know, it's very common in government circles as well, and anything to do with the civil service, really. You don't commission reviews unless you make sure you get the right people in who are going to give you the results you wanted. And they wanted masks to be. They wanted the groups to say, "Yeah, masks should be worn."
I remember a slip of the tongue from, I think it was Harriet Harman during the Labour years, where she said that she was involved in what was the phrase? It was policy-driven evidence finding.
That's pretty much it. So the point was let's get the right people together, going to give us the results we want. Mm-hmm. Let's make sure we don't have anyone neutral or on the fence here. We'll pack it full of masks.
But the Royal Society, aren't they supposed to be sort of the gold standard for this sort of stuff?
Yeah, they used to be. Well, maybe they never used to be, but they certainly aren't now. Recent years, they're very much a political organisation now, and most of their output really has to do with pushing political agendas.
Right, okay. So who in this case were the right people?
The right people. Okay, well, the right people, it's a group called, I've got it written down here, it's called the Science in Emergencies Tasking COVID-19 bracket Set C group. And it was partly done through the British Academy as well. It was mainly written by three academics from Oxford's Leverhulme Centre for Demographic Science. And that's very much an activist department. So I've got a description of, well, their own description from their website says, they intend to disrupt, realign and raise the value of demography in science and society, producing real-time now casting of demographic processes with a focus on inequality, diversity, environmental context. And this will revolutionise the discipline of demography. So it's very much an activist department. This is not a bunch of disinterested, neutral academics. This is people are out to change, explicitly out to change society, and they're not even sort of embarrassed to put
that on. And they managed to get the obligatory reference to diversity and whatever else was in that word salad.
Yeah, and their research topics, so I've written down some of their research topics. We've got environmental context, demography and climate change, inequality and diversity, sociogenomics, nature and nurture, global sustainability, ethics, truth and trust. So all the key progressive buzzwords and phrases. So you've got to be very careful about taking anything they say, any of their output at face value. There's an agenda behind all this.
So if you're going to a group like this, you know just from what you've told me so far that they are going to be, these are current thing people.
Yeah.
So whatever the current thing is, it is unlikely that they are going to go against it.
Yeah, and some of them I would say, not just current thing people in the sense of following the current thing, but pushing the current thing, particularly the lead author, who I'll talk about in a minute. There's a slide, if we can put up the slide of the some of the faculty there. That's just a selection of some of them. It's the usual collection mm-hmm. of sociologists and geographers. You can tell that just by looking at them.
Can many we have the next them, slide, John?
Many of them come from other countries. They're all over-promoted, over-funded. If you look at the first line of their faculty bios, if you want to torture yourself and go onto their website, you'll see research interests like diversity, environmental measures, social epidemiology, gender power and sexual decision-making, urban poverty, inequality issues amongst Africans in the diaspora, and so on.
Right.
So that's the kind of department they are. So you know, whatever they're going to produce, it's not going to be a surprise. They're not going to come up with the wrong answers, are they?
Now, how does this work in academia? Are these people like salaried employees who are sort of waiting around for somebody to come along and ask them to do a study, or do they go and get funding and that supports their work?
They've got lots of funding. These there's a lot of these sort of new departments. They've often got the word global in their name, global this and global that. Hmm. They usually get funded by billionaires, philanthropists, or
Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, by any chance?
I'm not sure in this case. I haven't looked into that.
But that sort of thing.
That sort of thing. Or they get funded by ESRC, the research councils, which are government funded. They're generally not teaching undergraduates. Some of them do to some degree. Mostly it's just very large departments that don't really do much teaching. They're just there to produce prodigious amounts of output in terms of, you know, rubbish, progressive, left-wing, green, climate change papers.
Okay, so presumably the head of this department, the Melinda Mill, she will be involved in going out and securing that funding, and then the rest of these people are effectively sort of salaried employees, you know, who are just churning out stuff, and every so often it's, you know, all hands to the mill because they've got a big new project such as the one that you're about to talk about.
Yeah, they're churning out loads and loads of stuff in their own journals, which publish that sort of stuff. Okay. I mean, I don't know how the funding came in. Often the case is that a billionaire comes along and says, I want to fund something like this, or they talk to some academics who say, I'd like to put some money into academia. What needs funding in academia? And those academics, their eyes will light up with pound signs, and they'll say, well, actually, we need something like this. And the billionaires will say, yes, oh, sure, I'll put money into that.
And do you have any experience of how this works from the other side, from government? Because, of course, I can understand that, you know, governments are, you know, they're a bunch of midwits who have successfully won an election. And so they don't want to make these decisions on their own when it comes to seeking scientific advice. So presumably that's then the job of the chief scientific officer to vet which groups are the right groups to ask the right questions.
Yes, that's right. So, I mean, government often doesn't have much control or power here. I mean, it could do if it chose to, but you know, conservative governments, as we know, tend to be pretty lily-livered, so they just let the chief scientific types run things. And you've got all these chief scientific officers and chief medical officers, and you've got a whole bunch of scientists working in the background who've got into those positions over the years, over the decades. You know, people like Neil Ferguson have been in power for like 20 years. So they've elbowed their way into these positions of power, and they pretty much run the shots. And it's a very brave government who goes against them. I'm not saying we should absolve the government of responsibility.
No, absolutely.
The government should have had the guts to stand up and say, well, hang on, I'm not going to go along with all this.
Okay.
But given you've got a cowardly conservative government, as you so often do, they just basically follow what the scientists tell them. And it's not just, you know, a few scientists, it's not just Witte and Valance and Ferguson. You've got massive amounts of scientists there working behind the scenes in all these positions of power, and all these academic departments who are, as you say, they're kind of on standby, ready to be brought in at a moment's notice to provide the sort of reports that are required. So most government ministers and civil service officials are going to say, oh, well, we
you know, we better defer to these academics because they know what they're talking about.
So this is the team that our chief scientific officer went to and said, okay, we're going to need you to take a look at masks. Can you take us through the process that this team then embarked on?
Well, they put out a terrible report. It was written by three of the academics from this department. Mm-hmm. Melinda Mills was the lead author. I suspect probably a few postdocs or postgrads were drafted in to do some of the grunt work mm-hmm. as well. I'd just say a bit about Melinda Mills. She is on SAGE. She's on the SPY-B right. committee. I don't know if she was on SAGE at that time. She certainly was soon after, because it's quite hard to find records of who was on SAGE at that exact time. You remember it was only a bit later after public pressure that they released the lists of who was on SAGE. And some people chose not to be named.
I remember that they had no epidemiologists on SAGE for at least the first year or something like that. And it was only after that was pointed out that they thought, okay, we better put one on. From what I could tell, it just appeared to be a bunch of communists.
Yeah, it pretty much was a bunch of communists.
Okay, so she's on SAGE.
She's on the SPY-B committee, which is the behavioural science arm.
Ah, okay.
Which is the arm that is in charge of manipulating and gaslighting the British people.
Right, okay. So she's on the bit that deals with, psychological manipulations.
Yeah, possibly she got on that bit after producing this report. It might have been a kind of audition piece.
Okay, because of course... The way that I would look at this is government was well aware, and we've just seen the clip, that masks had no benefit in terms of preventing, whatever it was that was going around. I mean, I know flu disappeared at exactly the same time that COVID came along, but let's say, COVID was, a genuine threat. We know that masks had no impact, and they knew that it had no impact, but it most certainly did have a powerful psychological impact. So the lead author of the analysis that pushed face masks is somebody whose primary focus, at least on the government side of things, was psychological manipulation rather than health protection.
Yes, and she's not really an expert in the field. I've written a few notes on who she is. She's mm-hmm. a Canadian-Dutch sociologist. She's published a paper. So she's not like any kind of medical expert. She's a sociologist. She's published a paper claiming that vaccine passports increase vaccine uptake. She's chaired a government review into vaccine passports. She's generally in favour of them. Mm-hmm. She's a member of a high-level European Commission group, which advises the EC's economic commissioner on, I quote, the main economic and social challenges the European economy will face in the post-COVID environment. So she's really into all this stuff. She's on various other governmental and official bodies, as well as international ones like Population Europe. She's a member of the Council of Advisors.
What is the purpose of Population Europe? Is it to increase the population of Europe?
Not really, no.
Right, okay.
No. She's got an MBE. She's a fellow of the British Academy. She's one of the governors of Nuffield College, Oxford. She's a member of the European Academy of Sociology. She's on the Executive Council of the Economic and Social Research Council. So she's basically as establishment as you can get. She's totally embedded.
So it's very fair to say that this individual is a known quantity, that when you commission a study from her, you can, I mean, for example, if I were to commission a study from her on, I don't know, any of the issues of the day, it would fall in line with whatever the narrative was. I mean, it's very much a known quantity, this
very
individual.
Much, yeah. Yeah. Okay. You're not going to get any surprises from her. She's also she also believes that anti-vaccine talk should be criminalised. So she's not really an independent and disinterested expert, is she? Not any kind of expert, let alone a disinterested one.
Yeah. We sometimes put the first few minutes of these talks out on YouTube, so we're hang back on what we think about vaccines until we get into the second half. But so possibly there might be some blowback coming her way as more evidence is revealed on that one.
I shall probably not be in any trouble there because there's so many people ahead of her in that queue, I think.
Yes, perhaps you're right. Okay, so what did she do after receiving the commission to find out if there was a case for face masks?
Okay, well, they produced this review. Mm-hmm. So they didn't do any independent study of their own. It's not an actual study in the sense that they went out and did some research. They just looked at the existing research, basically.
So this is a meta-analysis, is that what they call it?
Yeah, okay. Sometimes it's called literature review or a meta-analysis. It's neither really, because they don't do much reviewing and it's not much of a meta-analysis either. So it starts off complaining about some of the existing meta-analyses on masks. It complains that some of the studies that get included in these sorts of meta-analyses are underpowered. Some of them are set in non-community settings, meaning not in the real world. There's like hospital settings.
Oh, so there was a whole bunch of meta-analyses already out there.
Oh, there's been meta-analyses over the years, yeah.
So the government could have gone to any of them.
Oh, yeah, but they thought...
And why do you think they didn't go to any of those existing meta-analyses?
Because many... Well, one reason is many of them didn't produce the right results. Oh. They said there's no real evidence here of any use of masks. But there were some which said masks work, so...
Okay.
They could have gone to some of those, but I guess they preferred to have their own pet experts who would give them, they could be sure of giving them the right response. And it would also look like a topic current thing. I suppose if you went to a mask review from, say, 2012, people would say, well, this is not very current, is it?
Right, yes.
So they wanted a current one.
Because, of course, lungs and the atmosphere would have changed in those previous 10 years. And when you say that her criticism was that those studies were underpowered, what does that mean?
Well, that generally means there's not enough people in them, not enough subjects that are being looked at.
Oh, okay. So it's the number of people in the study rather than the amount of analysis applied or the amount of science done in the study.
Well, a bit of that, but mainly in terms of the number of participants.
Okay, so she only wants studies with lots of people, lots of science in it.
Well, that's what they say. I mean, it starts off making these complaints about the existing reviews. But of course, and they also said, that's the other thing. The other thing they said was, we want to do a review that's focused on cloth masks because most of the existing reviews are focused on N95s, the so-called higher quality masks, or surgical masks. And they wanted to look at just ordinary cloth masks. They said, we need to look at studies that just look at the sort of things that people are actually going to wear, you know, out in the street.
Because I suppose it never occurred to anyone before this time that wearing a bit of T-shirt over your face was a sensible thing to do.
That's right.
So this problem had never been solved. Right. I know we're going to get into the guts of this. Before we lose people who are just tuning in on the preview that we put out on YouTube, do you want to quickly mention your book?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Because if people want to go into the detail of this, I mean, you're going to talk to me about a small aspect of basically one chapter, aren't you?
Well, one section of a chapter.
Right, okay.
Yeah. So my book's called The Face Mask Cult. And it goes into very great detail about masks, giving you, first of all, like answers to the FAQs that you have about masks, then looking at in some depth at one batch of studies on something called the Gesundheit machine, which is a machine for collecting droplets. People basically stick their head into a big tube and talk and cough and sing or whatever.
Sounds fun.
And it collects the emissions that come out of the mouth to see, you know,
right,
what difference masks make. And that's actually really fun. It's really funny and interesting. You might not believe it, but it is. Okay. Then in the chapter after that, I look at the reviews. So this review, the other one that the Royal Society did, which was called the Delve Review, and also the government released a review a couple of years ago through the Department for Education about masks, which you may remember. So I look at those in detail.
When I looked at this, I mean, you have done basically the definitive study on this. I mean, I haven't seen any other books that sort of get into this. So, I mean, this is the definitive look at...
I hope so. Yeah. I think so. I mean, Ian Miller put out his own book, which I expect is very good, but he's sort of more looking at actual figures in the real world at the current time, whereas I'm focusing on...
You're dismantling the academia.
The scientific literature. Okay. So in the last chapter, I do a literature review, looking through most of the past mass studies and meta-analyses. And I should add before I forget, I think it is a fun read. It sounds pretty dry. Okay. You might think, oh, God, that sounds boring.
Yeah.
But people have commented on how enjoyable it is to read.
I've seen your blog. You've definitely got a wit to the way you write. So, yeah, check that out. So returning to this particular study, I mean, was it a big study that they produced? Details?
No. I mean, so after complaining about past reviews relying on small studies that weren't set in the real world and so on, what they did was the studies they looked at were all pretty small, none of which were in the real world. So it's very hypocritical to do that, to say, well, we want to look at these sorts of studies, and then you come up with a bunch of studies which have all those same faults. Mm. So they only actually, in the first half of the review where they're looking at whether masks stop people from passing on the disease or any kind of disease, they looked at four studies only.
Four?
Yeah, only four. They're all Chinese studies.
So when I looked into this myself, and I'm not an academic of any sort, but early on in the pandemic, I went looking at the evidence on masks, and I found at least four pretty good, high-quality studies out there. None of them are Chinese, and that's what I found personally. So a bunch of academics managed to find basically the same number as I did.
Well, they could filter pretty much all studies out because they said, we just want cloth mask studies, which meant that they could get rid of pretty much every study in existence because most of those studies didn't just look at cloth masks. And they said, oh, we want them to have certain controls and so on.
But if an N95 doesn't work, a cloth mask isn't going to work.
You would think so, yes.
Okay, right. So,
of course, there were some studies which show that N95s do work. You can find all sorts of things in the literature. The literature is pretty low quality.
The ones I found early on found that yes, the N95s do work as long as you put them on in sterile conditions and then you don't touch them all day, which is unrealistic.
Yeah.
And if you basically break any of those rules, then it sort of ceases to function after that. So basically, the vast majority of the existing studies, which is presumably why we saw that video of politicians saying that masks don't work, were excluded, and only four, and they were all Chinese.
Yeah, although I should say one of them also involved Hong Kong, if that improves things. Well, yeah. If that improves things for you.
Possibly. Okay.
Yeah. And they're all pretty small studies and very low quality, so I'll talk a bit about them.
Yeah, please do.
I should say, first of all, there was one pretty good study on cloth masks done in the past, which they managed to exclude for dubious reasons.
Was that the Danish one?
No, this was done a few years ago by a professor at the University of New South Wales. And it's by the standards of the field, it was a pretty good quality study. I mean, it's a low quality field, so I'm not saying it was a great study, but it was far higher quality than any of these ones. But because it didn't have quite the sort of controls they wanted, they managed to exclude it. Probably, though, because the real reason was probably because it didn't give them the results they wanted. It found that cloth masks didn't really do anything and perhaps possibly made things a bit worse. So they managed to exclude that one.
So, I mean, this is sort of helpful to an extent that if you look at their list of what they excluded, well, it was the vast majority of studies that they excluded.
Yeah.
And it just so happens that those are also the ones that gave them the wrong answer, that... And it was almost like they were hunting for a reason to exclude the studies that were vigorous and proved that masks didn't work.
Yeah. It looks very much, I'm not saying for sure that they did this deliberately, but it looks like they did. One can surmise, you know. I don't want to make accusations that might be hard to actually back up, but it kind of looks like that.
But you could find no cogent reason.
Not really. I mean, the reason they use to exclude is based on a lack of controls.
So do the four studies that were left in, do they have oodles of controls that the other ones lacked?
They had control arms, but they had various issues, such as so many other protective factors occurring at the same time, that they were actually terrible studies in that regard.
So should we take a look at some of these studies see what actually made the cut for why we had to wear these damn things for 2 years?
So I can see on the screen you've got up the list of four studies. So let's look at the second one, first of all. This is the one by Liu et al. It's called Risk Factors for SARS Infection Among Hospital Healthcare Workers in Beijing, a Case Control Study. And this was published in Tropical Medicine and International Health in 2009. Now, what it showed was a small effect for cloth masks, just a small effect. We should note that this study didn't take place in a community setting, that is, in a normal real-life setting. It took place in a hospital on the front line of SARS. And I should point out that SARS has very different characteristics to COVID. And it involved doctors and nurses who were in very close contact with SARS patients and often performing emergency procedures on them. So
they're right in the face of...
Yeah. Yep. So it doesn't really have much relevance to ordinary people wearing cloth masks for COVID. Another big problem it had was it was a retrospective recall study, which means it relies on people correctly remembering whether they wore masks or not after they knew whether they got SARS or not.
Right, okay.
And obviously that can affect your recall, whether you got it or not. There's no guarantee to start with that you remember accurately, and once you know whether you've got SARS or not, that can definitely affect your recall.
So, I mean, there's definitely memory selective effects that are all over the sort of issues with this one. So this meta-analysis only wanted high-powered studies,
That's the impression they gave. They didn't actually specifically say that, but they certainly gave that impression.
So does this one qualify on that?
No, well, there's a retrospective recall issue, which any study which relies on retrospective recall is generally considered to be a poor quality and shouldn't be in a review like this. It's not a particularly big study, and there's all these other protective factors going on.
So that's the 477 people. That's the total number of people that was in this study.
I can't remember exactly how much this one had in it, but yeah.
It says sample size 477.
Yeah, it says that then. Yeah.
Okay, so they found a small benefit for masks, cloth masks?
A small benefit for cloth masks. So see if I can see the screen there. 12.5% versus 6%. So a small effect, not a big effect.
And, okay.
You know, given that it's a small sample size, that's not very, I mean, it's statistically significant, but it's not really worth much in terms of being confident.
Yeah, so the total study was about 500 people, 250 in each pot, you say, and it was 6% versus 12%. I mean, you're dealing with sort of 20 versus 30 people, something like that.
Yeah, it's not a massive difference. And also, you've got all these other protective factors at play. So I'll go through some of them. You've got, so they said that they found that wearing eyeglasses reduced infection, not protective goggles, just normal eyeglasses.
Like the ones you're wearing now.
I'm wearing, yeah. They reduced infection. Performing nose washes reduced infection, so did taking prophylactic antiviral medicine.
Okay.
Yet, you know, you didn't have anybody going around, you didn't have anybody in the COVID hysteria complex going around saying we should be doing these things.
Yeah, wearing glasses.
Yeah, and the authors of this paper didn't make anything of these results either. So you look in the details of some of these papers, you find all kinds of bizarre results, which should make you think, well, maybe this paper isn't really all that good. Mm. They also found that wearing disposable masks slightly increased your risk of getting SARS. And wearing a mask with one layer, like most cloth masks are made of one layer, almost doubled your risk of infection.
So this study actually proves the opposite of what they were trying to demonstrate.
Yeah, in a way it does. I mean, we're not talking very big numbers, but that kind of means you shouldn't take the study seriously.
Is the one they included.
This is one they included, and this wasn't a very good study.
Well, and it demonstrates the opposite of what they wanted it to demonstrate. So far the evidence isn't looking good. Presumably the other three are high quality.
Yeah, you'd think so. Well, let's look at the third paper on the list. This one's called Effectiveness of Precautions Against Droplets and Contact in Prevention of Nosocomial Transmission of Severe Acute Respiratory Syndrome, SARS. Name.
This is the Soet et al., is it? This is the Hong Kong one, is
CITO
it?
One CITO one from The Lancet in 2003. Okay. Now, the first thing I know about this, it's a very short paper. It's only 13 paragraphs long.
Right.
So it barely qualifies as a scientific paper, really. And it's got very small numbers, and particularly got a tiny number of infected subjects. There were 13 people infected in this study.
So looking at this, it had 100 people in total, and only 13 of those were infected. So it's basically a study of just over a dozen people.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It's not, the numbers really aren't big enough to make it worth taking seriously. Also, it was a hospital study again, not a community study. It was on SARS again.
Okay.
And it was also a retrospective recall study.
Ah.
So, okay. Again, it has all these faults that mean that it shouldn't really be included on any list of papers in a serious literature review or meta-analyses.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.